This is NASCAR driver Tony Breininger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. She's one of journalism's pioneers, raised in the segregated South. In 1961, Dorothy Butler Gilliam became the first black female reporter at the Washington Post. She came of age during the Civil Rights Movement and the Women's Movement. She paved the way for countless young journalists of color who followed in her footsteps. And today, she's out with a new memoir. Dorothy Butler Gilliam shares the story of her 60-year career in journalism and her efforts to help shape American newsrooms. So this hour on Point, Dorothy Butler Gilliam, a pioneering journalist's fight to make the media look more like America. And you can join us. Do you think American newsrooms should reflect the nation's diversity? What stories are we missing with a lack of media diversity? Or do you think American journalism has much bigger problems to face now? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, Dorothy Butler Gilliam joins us today from Washington. Her new memoir is titled Trailblazer, A Journalist's Fight to Make the Media Look More Like America. She's a veteran reporter, a former editor and columnist at the Washington Post. She also served as the president of the National Association of Black Journalists and of Unity, Journalists of Color. Dorothy Butler Gilliam, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here, Meghna.
It's a great pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you, Meghna.
I wonder if you could just sort of start off by telling us the story of, you know, of was journalism something that you kind of always wanted to be when you grew up, or how did you get into it?
It was not my focus when I was in high school, or even when I finished college. In fact, I thought I was going to be a children's lawyer, and that I think shows how much I wanted to advocate for people. But what happened was I was 17 years old. I was attending Ursuline College in Louisville, Kentucky, and I had the opportunity to work after my classes as a secretary for the local black newspaper called the Louisville Defender. And one day the editor, Mr. Stanley, came in and told me, I want you to go substitute for the social editor or the society editor because she's out ill. And I was shocked, but I wanted to take the chance. And I went out and I started writing these stories for the society page. I'm the daughter of a minister. And I did not know about black, quote, society. It wasn't a very large group in Louisville, Kentucky. But it was just interesting to see how, by covering them, how journalism kind of instantly opened me up to new worlds.
Yeah.
So this was another world that I had not known existed.
Well, so and it was. I'm sorry to interrupt here, but as I just want to ask you that, as you were saying, so this was, a black newspaper in Kentucky at the time.
Yes, it was.
What role did those particular newspapers play in the black community in that era?
Those newspapers played a very important role. One of the most important roles they played was during the years before 1954 and the desegregation of schools, or at least the court ruling on the desegregation of schools, because they would spend a lot of time in the segregated South writing stories about what was happening. They were really going behind the cotton curtain that the white newspapers were not paying any attention to. And the black newsmen, and mostly men, they would have to slip into these areas in the South at night sometimes. They would often have to wrap their old portable typewriters in clothing that looked as though they had old clothing. So because the police did not want the stories that they were writing to be told across America. So the first black newspaper started way back in actually the 18th century, but their crucial role was doing that pre-civil rights movement, when they went places that white newspapers and white reporters didn't know about and didn't want to go.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so then tell us a little bit more about where your career moved after that. I'm thinking particularly of when you worked as a reporter at the Tri-State Defender in Memphis.
Yes. Yeah. What happened at that point, I wanted to, when I finished Lincoln University in Jefferson City, Missouri, I was interested in going to a white newspaper. For some reason, that seemed to be the right move to make because, you know, it was kind of the early beginnings of the civil rights movement, and Martin Luther King Jr. was encouraging black people, young black people, to go into white corporations. But when I tried to get a job at my local newspaper, the Courier-Journal in Louisville Times, there was no interest whatever. So I was happy to finally get a job at the Tri-State Defender in Memphis. And what happened at that newspaper, I was definitely a rookie, but my editor, Mr. L. Alex Wilson, he went to cover the integration of Little Rock. That is when the 9 young people were trying to integrate Central High School.
In 1957.
And Mr. Wilson was viciously beaten by a white mob outside the school because I think they thought he was one of the parents of the children. And he was with several other reporters. Most of the reporters ran and jumped into their car. He refused to run, and he was very badly beaten. He had left me back in Memphis to cover the local stories. But when I turned on the television and saw that he had been beaten, I had to go to Little Rock. And so I called this photographer, Ernest Withers, and I said, we've got to go to Little Rock. And that's how I ended up covering a little bit of Little Rock, but he did the main covering.
Yeah. You know, I just wanted to say here that 1957 was just, 3 years after Brown v. Board
absolutely.
In 1954. So what happened in Little Rock was a key moment here. So when you did go with that photographer, as you're saying, what did you see? What were the stories that you reported after Mr. Wilson, you know, suffered at the, you know, that terrible beating you were talking about?
Well, one of the things I saw and witnessed was the pressure that the local police was putting on black people in the city. For example, when we arrived in Little Rock, we drove directly to the home of Daisy Bates, who was the NAACP person who was kind of the overseer for these 9 children who were trying to integrate Central High School. And so there was a lot of discussion about how dangerous it was just for people who were not directly involved. But also, it was also very dangerous for people at the home of Daisy Bates. And I was there as a very young reporter, but I was just able to kind of sit in her basement and listen to some of the older reporters talk about what had occurred and how they had worked so hard to try to get the story of what was happening to the larger community, to the larger black community, because most of them did work for black newspapers. There were one or two exceptions. For example, Carl Rowan had worked for the Minneapolis Tribune, and Ted Poston had worked for the New York Daily News. But mostly, you know, it was just the opposite, yeah, where they were working for the black press.
Do you think that at the time, and again, we're talking about the mid to late 1950s here, mm-hmm, that the coverage or the kinds of stories that these black newspapers were telling about things like what happened in Little Rock, that the coverage was different? Was it demonstrably different than what the mainstream press was offering at the time?
Well, I think it's important to realize that the mainstream press totally ignored the black community until after the 1954 Supreme Court ruling about integrating the schools. And then there began to be, you know, some interest in you know, covering because it was affecting the white population. But for, you know, centuries, very little attention had been paid by the white newspapers to what was happening in Black America. In fact, in many ways, it was it appeared that the white mainstream media was part of the problem, not part of the solution. So it was after the riots, after the urban uprisings of the mid '60s, that there was a commission called the Kerner Commission set up to really find out what role had white newspapers played in these riots, mm-hmm. These uprisings. And basically, the Kerner Commission said that the news media, the white news media, basically was guilty of kind of helping there be two separate Americas because they were only reporting the media through white eyes.
Uh-huh.
And so that was kind of a wake-up call for the media. Now, you know, when I first started at the Post in 1961, it was before the Kerner Commission, you know, before the newspapers, you know, began to really get some negative press and some negativity from the larger country because they had failed to tell the American people about what was happening in any community other than white communities.
Right. You know what? So that's so interesting. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about your career, how it grew, your time at the Washington Post as the first Black female reporter there, and then this underlying issue that even the Kerner Commission so long ago brought up about what kind of stories are told in the American media. So Dorothy Butler Gilliam, stand by. We are talking with a genuine trailblazer in American journalism. Dorothy Butler Gilliam was the first Black female reporter at the Washington Post. And we're talking about her efforts, her long-term efforts to make American newsrooms look more like the country they're reporting on. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Dorothy Butler Gilliam. She was the first Black female reporter at the Washington Post, and she has a new memoir out. It's called Trailblazer, A Pioneering Journalist's Fight to Make the Media Look More Like America. So, Dorothy, let's just get right to your time at the Washington Post, because I know that, of course, you did go to Columbia Journalism School before going to the Post. But I just want to jump straight to 1961. How did you end up as the Washington Post's first Black female reporter?
Well, I was interviewed at Columbia upon time for graduation. And the person who interviewed me, Ben Gilbert, told me that he was interested in me, but I just did not have any daily newspaper experience. So I should go out to some smaller newspapers, but keep in touch. And then in the letter he wrote, he said, if you happen to be in Washington, just stop by and meet our managing editor. And I said, okay. And it was the kind of letter that was not a turnoff. It was, he clearly recognized that I needed some, you know, daily experience. It turned out that I was going to Africa for the summer as a part of a program called Operation Crossroads Africa. And this was the summer after my graduation. And of all things, we were having our orientation before our trip to Africa in Washington, D.C. So I called Mr. Gilbert and said, told him I was in town, and he said, well, come by. And I went down to the post, took the bus, and when I met the managing editor, whose name was Al Friendly, he said, why are you in Washington? And I said, well, I'm going off to Africa for 2 months. And he found that kind of intriguing and asked if I wanted to write any stories for him. And I said, certainly. And I did, as well as for my local Louisville Defender. I think my Columbia degree added some interest in my becoming a journalist for a white newspaper. But the stories I wrote, I don't think they ever were carried by the Post. But I think newspapers are often looking for people who have that extra interesting, twist in their life. The young people who are looking for who want to do different things, mm-hmm. and so he was interested in that. So that's how I ended up at the Washington Post, even though I had no daily newspaper experience except the experience I'd gotten at Columbia.
Yeah. So what was it like being in that newsroom in the early years?
Well, Magna, that was a different story. It was, I was shocked. First of all, I grew up in the segregated South, so I knew the harshness of segregation. I was shocked to find out when I got to Washington that although the population of Washington was over 50% then, that I faced the same issues as in the segregated South. Taxis wouldn't pick me up. That may sound, that's not that important. But for a daily newspaper reporter, when you're given your assignment in the morning and you're expected to come back and write it for the next day's paper, any time you lose not being able to have a transportation back and forth to work, it is a big problem.
Right.
And it was very frustrating. And what happened, luckily, was that I had taken shorthand when I was at Ursuline College. This was a Catholic women's college I attended before going into majoring in journalism. And they, at that point, women as secretaries were a very big deal. So they said, you must learn shorthand. So my shorthand came in handy because I would be standing on the corner somewhere, writing the story in shorthand before I got to the office. And so at least it gave me one heads up in terms of, I'd be able to make my deadline. And
wow.
I'm sure there's sometimes I miss deadlines.
Wow. But so shorthand allowed you to try to circumvent the problem of taxi drivers not picking you up because you were black. Wow.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it was frustrating and it was difficult. There were times when at first, didn't want to stereotype myself. I'm going to cover any story. So I was going out. They sent me to a birthday party of a 100-year-old woman. And when I got there, the doorman said, you can't come because the maid's entrance is around the back. And I said, I'm not a maid. I'm a reporter. And, I whipped out my press pass, and he said, just wait outside. And he reluctantly went in to this apartment building, and it turned out that I really was supposed to be there. So there were all the kind of small frustrations.
Wow.
But I think more to the point, it was so crucial to be able to not come back and complain, because I felt that would make it more difficult for the next African American woman who they, might apply or they might consider hiring.
Uh-huh.
We can't hire them, because they can't get taxi cabs. So that was one of the things I didn't do and felt I couldn't do, which would come back to the office and it really, describe what it was like in order to get the stories that I had to write.
Well, so let me ask you about that because, in 1961, you were a very new reporter at the Post. But kind of underlying what's in your book and this conversation is this question of, if we want more diversity in newsrooms, why is that? It's to get a more diversity of viewpoints and of stories, right? To cover America in an accurate way. So in 1961, though, as the only black female reporter at the Washington Post, I mean, what kind of stories were you being assigned? were you able to sort of bring your life experience to bear as a black woman through your reporting, or were you just being assigned things that were totally irrelevant?
Well, I very quickly sort of decided I didn't want to be assigned irrelevant stories. Mm. And, you know, the war on poverty was beginning, and I wanted to be a part of that. I was very happy to go out into black communities, cover stories about welfare, cover stories about poverty. So I think the real importance of having diversity is that you really get another community. You know, you really have a person who can go and ask questions and who can delve and who have some historical reference to report on what is going on. And I found this as throughout my career, that it made such a difference when I later became a columnist, when I could that I could go and find out what's going on in the communities, that people would share with me. I found it out also when I went to cover the integration of Ole Miss. Mm-hmm. I was specifically sent to to talk to the black community to see what would be their reaction to this integration of this university that was, you know, the bastion of white supremacy.
Right.
And the fact that I was there, I was interested, I talked to them, was very, very crucial to the story I got, for example, because I got a different story. I read later from, you know, some white reporters talked about the blacks who were so afraid that they took to the hills. But the story I got was a story of a mood of yes, fear, but a mood of hope as well.
Uh-huh.
Because they were determined, you know, to make a difference.
So let me just jump in here, because this is 1962 you're talking about, right?
Right.
And Oxford, Mississippi, when James Meredith became the first black student admitted to the University of Mississippi, or Ole Miss. And as people remember, should remember, there was a series of violent riots after that. And you were sent down to report on this story, as you say. But just to sort of remind people about the mood at that moment in 1962, I mean, here's a news report we have, a television report from the days following James Meredith's enrollment at Ole Miss.
Nearly 6,000 troops patrol Oxford to maintain order, and arrests mount to more than 200 as smaller disturbances erupt the next day. Former Major General Edwin Walker, who came here from his home in Texas, is put under arrest and held in high bail on charges of inciting insurrection. He was flown to a federal prison hospital as relative calm settled on the town in the greatest crisis the South has faced since the Civil War.
That's a news report from 1962, when James Meredith was the first black student admitted to the University of Mississippi. So, Dorothy Butler Gilliam, you were saying you were talking to members of the black community there in Oxford. Tell me a little bit more about what they were telling you.
Well, they were telling me, first of all, that they were just shocked that in Mississippi, which really was the land of black death, Mississippi was a lynching state. Mississippi was a state that where, you know, a young man named Emmett Till was shot and thrown into the Tallahatchie River because he purportedly whistled at a white woman. Mississippi was a place that people dreaded. Black people dreaded. And one of the reasons I wasn't truly frightened when I went to Mississippi is that I was accompanied by the same Ernest Withers, a photographer who lived in Memphis and just who knew the South and who knew how to negotiate the South. And when I arrived in, and when he and I were driving from Memphis to Oxford, Withers, we were stopped by two white guys in a in a pickup truck with gun racks on the top of their truck. And, you know, Withers knew how to go out and say yassa and nosa, whatever it took to get us where you help us reach our destination. Huh. So Mississippi was just such a horrible place, such a place where white supremacy, reigned in such a vicious way that it wasn't surprising to me that the black people I interviewed were somewhat fearful. But what surprised me was how much hope they had. Mm-hmm. And when I left Oxford, I went to Jackson and I interviewed Medgar Evers.
Right.
And a few months later, he was killed. And he again shocked me when he said, getting Meredith into the University of Mississippi is only the first step. We are going to keep trying. We're going to get people in other universities in Mississippi. So it was, the whole civil rights movement was a period of such enormous transformation in the society.
Mm-hmm.
Because the civil rights movement in many ways led to the women's movement, and each, each group has fought for that kind of freedom and in the society.
Yeah. I'm thinking about all these experiences and the work that you're talking about that you did. I'm trying to get myself out of the 2019 context where there's always immediate reaction to any news story that appears, because I wanted to ask you, well, what kind of reaction were you getting from your stories appearing in the pages of the Washington Post? Is that a fair question to ask? Did you hear from people? Because of course, if these stories today, your social media stream would be flooded with people saying, "Here's what I think about your stories."
Yeah, but you're talking about not just Mississippi, but you're talking about some of the later stories that I wrote, or do you want to focus?
Or
on Mississippi?
I mean, anything. I guess maybe what I should be asking you is, did you feel that your reporting was making a difference? And if so, how did you get a sense to that?
Okay, I think. I really felt my reporting was making a difference as a columnist, and I can talk about the style section in that work also. But because I had the opportunity not just to write, features, but to really have an opinion, that was very, very important to me. Now, my columns were not always admired, internally, but most of the time they were really, I think, appreciated in the communities. In many ways, I think African-American communities have thought about, white newspapers as the big white newspapers downtown, because they are not reaching out. They're not really talking about some of the differences, some of the distinctions between the black and other communities. So there has been this concern for years, and I think it still exists to a certain degree, because diversity even now is not what it should be in terms of having representation of all races. And it's been, it's really been one of my fights to try to have that change.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, make the case here, because given all the challenges that of the American news media faces today, whether it's, consolidation, whether it's the president of the United States calling the media the enemy of the people, how pressing do you think genuinely this need is to make newsrooms more diverse in the context of these other challenges?
Well, I do not minimize the other challenges. I think the challenges that are now being raised by the administration and the false monikers of false news and fake news, this is a very destabilizing force within the United States as well as externally in the larger world, because around the world, people have looked to America as as, you know, this bastion of democracy. And even though I know as an African American that there's been in so many ways that the United States has not practiced democracy equally, mm-hmm. It still is very, very important. It's a goal that we all work toward. But the smaller issue within the lack of diversity is that we still have communities that feel unrepresented. They feel as though they're pushed to pledge allegiance to a country that doesn't pledge allegiance to them.
You know what, Dorothy, stand by here for a second because we do have to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to pick up on this thought with you about the American media today and how it covers and tells the stories of the country as a whole. So we'll be right back. We're talking with Dorothy Butler Gilliam. She is the first Black woman who served as a reporter at The Washington Post. She has a new memoir out. It's called Trailblazer. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Dorothy Butler Gilliam. In 1961, she became the first Black female reporter at the Washington Post, went on to become a section editor there at the Post and a columnist as well. She has a pioneering career in journalism that spans more than six decades. Her new memoir is called Trailblazer, A Pioneering Journalist's Fight to Make the Media Look More Like America. And Dorothy, we're going to talk more about your views about American newsrooms today here, but I've been making our callers wait very patiently. So let me let a few of them in if I can. So let's go to Richard, who's calling from Delta, Pennsylvania. Richard, you're on the air.
Thank you for accepting my call. Dorothy, congratulations. I can't tell you how much I praise you for being so aggressive and presenting yourself and being an advocate for the Black community. I am not Black, but I just praise you, and I want to say you are wonderful. You speak well, and you're great. Thank you for your career, and I appreciate your willingness to help and express yourself on the radio.
Well, Richard, thank you for your call.
Thank you very much, Richard. I appreciate that.
Let's go to Tom, who's calling from Manchester, Connecticut. Tom, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello, Magda. Congratulations to your guests. I'm of African-American background, and I agree. I was a toddler and a young preteen during the Civil Rights Movement, but I do remember those horrendous times with George Wallace and, you know, other, you know, demagogues. And you're right. A lot of people and whites put their, you know, their lives, you know, on the line for, you know, to get that right kind of story, out. And I feel like in today's media, we do need a free press. And, you know, hearing from the, you know, President, Trump, we got to lead by a better example, but we could be doing better. But I guess concern I have with the press sometimes, the way they can slant and censor stories. If I go to certain events or meetings, even though I don't want my, you know, name publicized, but sometimes what's left out, and they go by comments of, their board of directors, and you feel like you're, you know, left out, or stories that they, you know, don't cover if, you know, they feel like they're taking the time. So, I mean, I'm for a free press. You guys do a great job. And going back to the Black press, you had North Star going back to slavery with mm-hmm. John Horsworm and Frederick Douglass, mm-hmm. and we do need more diversity in the newsroom, like with your predecessor, I think was Ethel Payne. I got her biography book, and she took some risks during the 40s and the 50s and discrimination that she had to do. And I'll end on this. I think reporters of color have come under scrutiny, and I don't like the way President Trump has treated women of color with, sex is put down and insulting names, and it goes well with black politicians and men of color, too. I think
Tom, can I just jump in here for a second? Yeah, because I'm sorry to interrupt you, Tom, but you bring up a very important point, and I appreciate your call very much. Dorothy Butler Gilliam, I was going to save this for a little later in the conversation, but let me just get straight to what Tom sort of ended there with. Which is, you were talking about how early on in your career in the segregated South in the 60s, you had to deal with a lot of challenges by virtue of being a black woman and how you were treated even as you were a reporter. Tom there referring to moments that the president of the United States today has had with black female reporters here. Now, of course, the president has made it no secret that he really disdains most of American media here. But do you feel like there's something particular in the way he treats black female reporters now?
It feels particularly pointed. I think part of it comes from, kind of ignorance of the country and the nation and of, just sort of basics. At one point, for example, when April Ryan was mentioning something about the Congressional Black Caucus, he thought it was her role to, put him in touch with her. To put him in touch with the Congressional Black Caucus.
Right, even though she's a White House reporter.
Exactly. So this was the first of, several negative, incidents and lack of understanding about just, really basics of America. But
let me just jump in here because we actually have some tape of several moments here. Because
okay.
I appreciate the delicacy with which you're approaching this because you're calling them unfortunate incidents. I think other people might call them awful incidents. I mean, we're just going to play a couple of here. This is, for example, you're going to hear how the president has treated three different very high-profile African-American female reporters. The first one is during a press conference at the White House in November when PBS NewsHour White House correspondent Yamiche Alcindor prompted a pointed response because she was asking the president a particular question. And President Trump responded very forcefully. Here's what happened.
On the campaign trail, you called yourself a nationalist. Some people saw that as emboldening white nationalists. Now people are also saying
that the president. That's such a racist question.
There are some people that say that now the Republican Party is seen as supporting white nationalists because of your rhetoric. What do you make of that?
I don't believe it. I don't know. Why do I have my highest poll numbers ever with African Americans? Why do I have among the highest poll numbers with African Americans? I mean, why do I have my highest poll numbers? That's such a racist question.
That's President Trump countering PBS NewsHour correspondent Yamiche Alcindor in November after a White House press conference. President Trump told veteran reporter April Ryan to sit down. I should say it was at a White House press conference. And then he told the press later that he believed she is a loser.
The same thing with April Ryan. I watch her get up. I mean, you talk about somebody that's a loser. She doesn't know what the hell she's doing.
And also in November, CNN's Abby Phillip asked the president if he wanted acting Attorney General Matthew Whitaker to rein in Robert Mueller. And here's how President Trump responded.
What a stupid question that is. What a stupid question. But I watch you a lot. You ask a lot of stupid questions.
Dorothy Butler Gilliam, I mean, yes, we picked those three out, but
yeah, I hear, and this is awful, beyond the most definitions of the word awful. It's why this country is so polarized right now, because with this kind of insanity almost coming from the highest level, this lack of basic human respect for just other human beings, this, you know, confusion about, you know, who, what, why, where we are right now. So it saddens me. It really does. I've seen this kind of destabilization in across the country as I talk to people who are just feeling, you know, confused. They obviously, you saw the people who went to the polls and did, you know, and certainly elected new people. But there a lot of damage is being done. And I don't think it doesn't do justice even to many of the people who support the president. So I can be strong and I can be delicate. Yeah. So I'm trying to tiptoe around the daisies here, as you probably say, yeah. Because you know, it's important to do that.
I get it. I mean, look, I can fully anticipate the kind of tweets and emails I'm going to get from people who say you cherry picked those moments, or the president had every right to say those things. He disdains all of the media, so why are you making a big deal of this? You know, folks, I get it. Bring it on. But what I really want to discuss and learn from you more, Dorothy, is regarding the media itself. I think it's fair to say, actually, that even with all the challenges that the American media is facing, some of them self-wrought right now, that don't you think that it has come a longer way? It has come quite a way from the, you know, the times where your earliest days as a reporter. I mean, regarding covering communities of color, the diversity of communities in the United States, at least there has been coverage. You can criticize it, the quality of it, but there has been coverage of, you know, everything like police related shootings, Black Lives Matter, you know, all the issues with schools across the country. There has been improvement in the coverage, hasn't there?
Yeah, Meghna, there has been, but there also has been a drop in the diversity in newsrooms. Mm-hmm. We know that the news media has undergone, you know, enormous economic pressures. So, you know, fewer newspapers are publishing. We're still in this new century journalism that's evolving, you know, with social media, et cetera. But and so I do think one of the problems is that we still don't have the diversity and the inclusion that would make the coverage better. I think we have to acknowledge progress, and I do acknowledge progress. But when I look at the past year, which was a year when you know, all these 50th anniversaries,
right.
The 50th anniversary of Kerner, the Kerner Commission, the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's assassination,
right.
When we were looking at all these events. In many ways, there were more Black reporters hired and having input after those events than there are now. For example, I am told by people who watch this probably more closely than I do, since I've been trying to write the book, but I'm told that there are very few African Americans who are, you know, even participating in the coverage of President Trump, even though we have to acknowledge that an African American is the one of the top editors at the New York Times. But in terms of, you know, the reporters on the street doing, you know, doing the footwork, you know, there aren't that many from in the Washington who are on the Washington Post team doing this. So and you might say, well, what difference does that make? The difference, once again, is that an inclusive country is a stronger country, a country that, you know, really represents all communities is a stronger country. And well,
go ahead, but I also want to get another call in here if I can. But go ahead and finish your thought, Dorothy, please.
Yes. I'm still on the board of the Maynard Institute, which was one of the ways we journalists of color and interracial groups got more journalists onto newspapers. We started training programs in the mid 70s and brought in people of Latinos, Asian Americans, Native Americans, Asian Americans, because we wanted that representation. What has happened is that as those numbers drop, in part because of the economy, you're still pushing to have representation. Mm. And that means that some of the things that happened to me when I was trying to hail a cab in 1961 happened today to black men when they are trying to hail a cab in New York City. Yeah. If they're not wearing a suit and a tie. Somehow we need to link these occurrences so we can have greater understanding. Mm-hmm. Right now, for example, there's so many African Americans who are concerned about their children because we've had police shootings, and they're people who there has been coverage of some. Social media has helped enable, for example, Black Lives Matter to emerge.
Yeah.
But I just think there's still layers that are overlooked that will enlighten us all each other.
Dorothy, your point is very well put and very well taken here. And we're just fast running out of time, but I want to get one more caller in, if I can. So let's go to Imani, who's calling from Detroit, Michigan. Imani, you're on the air.
Hi, Dorothy. Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for taking my call, squeezing me in. I will be very brief as much as I can. Thank you for the work you do. I am a black journalist in the city of Detroit. I work for a major media news outlet. I can't say what name. But I find it very hard to be this powerful black woman in this space because a lot of the times it's dominated by white people in the newsroom. And for me to want to say things and voice my opinion and stand up and fight for certain things is kind of like, we're not going to talk about that today. And I just want to really, I learned a lot from you, and I want to just see how is it that you've done it for so many years and stay powerful as you are without kind of just falling in the background like I feel like I'm doing.
Oh, Imani, thank you for your call. And Dorothy, love to hear your answer, but just want to let you know so I don't have to cut you off that we've got about a minute left to go, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, Imani, I think that we all as black people are very resilient. And, I have traced my resilience back to, my early religious life. Other people have other sources of resilience. But I think, we must keep fighting because we have to fight for those people. We as journalists, we have to fight for those people who don't have a voice. Those people who don't have the opportunity to be on national public radio, those people who don't have the opportunity to really say what their life is like, to share their sufferings. So I think that can continue to inform us as journalists when we get pushback from the still predominantly white male media. Hmm. We just have to take it. And we have to fight back and push back and know that in the end, we hopefully will win and have a better America.
Well, Dorothy Butler Gilliam's career in journalism spans more than six decades. She tells us all about it in her new memoir, Trailblazer, a pioneering journalist's fight to make the media look more like America. Dorothy, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Meghna. You are a wonderful interviewer.
It was a pleasure to speak with you. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.